Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, summer is in full swing, but how are pets handling the warmer weather? Jay Fox will speak with a veterinarian about summer pet health. Jay will also chat with experts on saving homeless cats and dental health for humans. Plus, Doug Petcash from Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up, on Columbus Perspective.
It is estimated that there are as many as 400,000 pet owners here in Columbus. With summer heat lingering long after Labor Day, it's important to keep your pets safe and secure from both heat, crowds, strangers, and noise. Dr. Michael Q. Bailey is the president of the American Veterinary Medical Association. He joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Welcome.
Good morning. Glad to talk with you.
I'm happy to talk with you, too. I'm a cat guy, but I know that there are lots and lots of dog people here in Columbus. But regardless, what should we do to prepare our homes and pets in advance of noisy summer celebrations?
Well, you know, the thing I always start off with, and it doesn't matter whether you're a dog or a cat lover, it's all the same. Be prepared. And you can start being prepared by making sure that your pet has identification on them. That's particularly the RFI chip. So if they should get away from you, whether it's out of your house because you have visitors, whether it's the noisy season when they're running scared, or whether you take them on a road trip, by having the identification and making sure that it's up to date, they can be returned to you very quickly, so you have a very short absence. So let's start with being prepared.
Now, when we go to a crowded party or a barbecue, what are the dangers that pets could face during an event like that?
Well, you know, people who want to treat your pet well are actually the biggest danger. Why? You have all that lovely party food there, and they want to share it with your pet after they're a member of the family. However, that food in itself can be a danger. We have diseases like pancreatitis that can come up. If you have a pet that has diabetes, depending on what they have, and then there's just the GI upsets. But, you know, you have those skewers which you did that kebab on, and it smells great to the dogs and the cat, and they start playing with it, and they eat it, and now you're in the emergency room that evening or the next evening to have a foreign body removed. So you want to be sure that everybody knows, no, there's no off-the-table food for the pets. You can even make some extra food for them so that they can give them some little things. But, you know, simple things like grapes can be toxic to your dog. So you have to warn folks, we're not feeding anything except what is pet-approved food.
Now, when we're talking about the heat in the summer, what is a risky situation for an animal that goes outdoors? Can they jump in the pool, or is the chlorine a problem? What do we do to keep them cool?
Well, you know, there's multi-factors going on here. And the chlorine in itself is no more harm to your pet than it is to you. So let's start off there. However, we have to start off. Their respiration is how they remove heat from their body. So if it's a hot, humid day, they're going to be panting. First of all, that moisture that comes out of their body is the way that they get rid of that heat. You have to make sure that they have lots of cool drinking water. And then if they're in an area enclosed, they cannot get rid of that heat, and the box just gets hotter and hotter because they're expelling the heat. So you have to be sure that there's at least some moving air around them so that the heat can be carried away from them. And those pets with long hair, you don't have to clip them, but you do have to make sure that they're well-groomed. That hair can protect them from the heat as well as it can from the cold. But if they're groomed, the matting will trap the hair against their body.
Should we put ice cubes in their water, or is that going to be a choking hazard?
No, ice cubes are actually no problem, and I actually like them better than some other things. I don't want them to have straight ice because you want them to have the water, and the ice cubes will help cool the water down. The other thing we should say, if it's really hot, the asphalt and the concrete can get hot outside. You want to be sure that you're taking them out early in the morning before it gets hot or late in the evening, and be sure you're walking on the grass and not the asphalt or the concrete.
Nobody likes burned paw pads.
That's right.
So if we're going out of town for a party or an event, is it appropriate to take our dog or leave them home during the summertime?
The answer is yes. It depends on the circumstances. If you take your pet with you, especially if you're crossing state or even more international borders, be sure you have taken them to your veterinarian and you have had a health certificate. That makes sure that they've had a thorough examination and they've had the required vaccinations. So I tell everybody, start by talking with your veterinarian, and that should be weeks, if not months, before you're going on the trip, because it can take a while for that to go along. As far as whether they should go with you or stay home, you know your pet better than anybody else, except maybe your veterinarian. Talk to them. Some pets travel well, other pets don't. If there's a pet that does not travel well, maybe you should find a good boarding facility, which is going to have air conditioning and other activities to keep them busy. And you know, when you're driving in that car, it's not a good idea to have your pet sitting in your lap. If you do have an accident, let's hope it's not caused by Fluffy, that airbag is going to go off and the pet is between you and the airbag. That can be deadly. They should be restrained properly in the back of the car, preferably with one of these pet-approved restraint devices.
Now, one thing I've always wondered about is that whenever people come to my house and visit my cats, they like to touch them. Is there any risk of contamination from a human hand to a pet like a cat or a dog? Because we don't know where these people's hands have been.
Actually, if you're keeping your pet clean, and believe me, you keep them clean and they're going to keep themselves clean also, the biggest risk is probably, does that human have an allergy to that particular pet? So I'm not overly concerned about the humans, as long as they don't have something like gasoline or whatnot on their hands. Let's hope not. I don't see a big problem there with the humans interacting with your pets. But, you know, I would suggest that they don't go up to the pet, particularly the first time. Let the pet come up to them.
Yeah, I think my cat Shadow would agree with that. He doesn't like to be approached. He'll find you.
That's right. Cats actually will find the people who like cats the least. So
that is very true. I have a tortie who is notorious for that. That being said, over the summer, there's a lot more stimulus than there is at other times of the year. After you've had your pet in a situation where they are highly stimulated, what is the best way to get them to calm down once you get them home?
Well, you're going to hear a theme here. I like preparation. If you know it's going to be a very stimulating day, let's say we're having fireworks, whether at Labor Day or even at Thanksgiving and whatnot, I like taking my pets out for long walks early on so that when evening comes, they're already tired. That way, they prefer to sleep than react to the stimulation. But if you know there's going to be other things going on, it's always good to find out what is the best room in the house that they can stay in. Should be nice and cool, something that's low-key. And I like turning on the radio. Some pets like talk radio. Some pets like music. Find something which you know calms them down and they are interacting with. If you do have a pet that gets constantly overstimulated, at the particular time of year, talk to your veterinarian. There are things that can be recommended, such as these shirts that can be put on, which calms them down. There's some over-the-counter medication. There are also some prescription medications, which can help anxiety. But, you know, I like trying the simple things first. Let's go out for a hike this morning, and you're going to be sleeping this afternoon.
Absolutely. That works for kids, too, by the way.
So I don't want to recommend anything for the kids, though.
No, absolutely not. That's not your purview, sir. All right. So for the folks that are listening to this interview who want more information on pet safety during the summertime and beyond, what is the best source for them to go to?
Two sources, your veterinarian and then avma.org. We have a plethora of information on the website that can help you find out what's the best way to deal with many situations. But your veterinarian knows your pet the best, and you have a healthcare team there. There's a lot of people there that like to sit down and talk with you and say, this is what's good for your particular Fluffy.
All right. We want to thank Dr. Michael Bailey, president of the American Veterinary Medical Association, for being with us this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Roughly 45% of Columbus residents have lost one or more of their teeth to tooth decay or gum disease. Nearly 37% of Ohio's impoverished seniors have no teeth at all. Dr. Craig Noblet is the president of the American Association of Endodontists, and he joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about what we can do to protect our natural teeth. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure. Dr. Noblet, why do so many Ohioans feel so strongly about keeping their natural teeth?
Well, I think it's become much more apparent to everybody that preserving your natural teeth contributes to your overall health. It preserves your ability to chew and eat, so you're able to maintain your nutrition. It preserves your natural smile, which is pretty central to our self-image when you think about it, and it's part of your personality. So losing teeth in that sense can be somewhat catastrophic for most people.
Now, there was a brand new survey that has given us some insight into how Ohioans and actually Americans really feel about their natural teeth. Did you find that the survey kind of echoed what you just said?
Absolutely. I think nationwide we've seen a definite upswing in the number of people who would like to preserve their natural teeth. It's getting close to 80% of people, when asked, would prefer to preserve their natural teeth versus having an extraction and going for a replacement, such as an implant.
How can treating a tooth infection impact somebody's overall health? We've heard for years that the eyes are the window to the soul, but my dentist says the teeth are the windows to the entire body.
It is the gateway, isn't it? Well, one of the main things, as I said, is if you are having pain in your mouth, it will affect your ability to chew and eat. You may actually avoid eating, which is terrible for your overall health if you don't maintain your nutrition. Also, a recent study that was published earlier this year out of King's College in London actually showed that timely and well-performed root canal treatment can actually lower the risk for heart disease and diabetes. So preserving your teeth does have benefits for your overall health.
Now, I know I've asked this before, but some of our listeners tend to forget things, and I'm one of them. What exactly is an endodontist, and what is the difference between an endodontist and a regular dentist?
Well, an endodontist is a dentist who receives an additional 2 to 3 years of training after dental school to specialize in root canal procedures. So we become the specialists at preserving natural teeth.
Let's talk about some basics. How many times should we brush our teeth a day?
I'd say at least 2 times, if not 3. Not everybody can brush their teeth after lunch, but if you're able to, that's preferable. But at least 2 times a day.
And what kind of toothpaste should we be using in 2026?
I would say use one that you like the flavor of and one that has fluoride in it. The fluoride helps strengthen your enamel against tooth decay and acid that is produced from your diet. And a pleasant flavor of the toothpaste will just help you remember to brush your teeth and not avoid it because you don't like the flavor of something.
Let's have a little fun. I'm 58 years old, and I've been using the same toothpaste since I was 10. What toothpaste do I use?
Oh, Crest?
No.
No?
No.
AIM?
Yes.
Oh, that's the one I used as a kid, too.
Absolutely. And you can get it for less than a dollar, and it serves the purpose. And this is not an endorsement for that toothpaste. It's just a little fun that we're having because we're getting to a certain age.
Yeah.
All right. We've addressed the toothpaste. Now let's get to the oral rinse. How many times a day should we be using an anti-plaque, antibacterial oral rinse?
Well, you can use that after brushing. So twice a day would be fine. But the most critical part is the brushing and flossing to remove the plaque from your teeth.
And should we be flossing every time we brush?
If you can, yeah. That helps remove the larger particles of plaque so that your brush just becomes more efficient. So you want to floss first and then brush.
And what should we be doing with our tongue and our gums?
Well, you'd like to brush your tongue also. If you stick your tongue out, look in the mirror, you may see a little bit of a film that generates on the surface of your tongue. So you can use your toothbrush with your toothpaste to brush that off. And the gums are actually stimulated with your toothbrushing as well. And the flossing helps contribute to gum health also.
If your gums bleed when you floss, does that mean you're doing something wrong or is there a problem?
No, your gums may bleed if they're inflamed slightly, but the more that you brush and floss, the less inflamed they will become and the more resilient. But also, if you have to use a lot of force to get the floss in, you might actually do a little trauma to the gum tissue and cause a slight amount of bleeding. But
is halitosis an indication of an illness?
Not directly. It could be that you need to brush your tongue as well, but usually not and a systemic illness.
Should we be brushing the roof of our mouth as well?
You can, yeah. That doesn't hurt, but it's more important to do your tongue.
And is an apple a day still recommended for good teeth health? See, I'm showing my age, and I don't really care.
Well, I don't know that you have to do an apple a day, but I think healthier snacks are a good idea. You want to eat things that are lower in sugar or more natural. Things like fruit is healthier for you.
Do they still do the vitamin C test?
No, not that I'm aware of.
You remember when that was a thing?
No, I don't. I'm
okay,
sorry.
Well, I must be older than you are because I remember as a kid going to the dentist, and that was a major thing, your vitamin C test. And then if you did not have the levels that you should have, you were either told to eat oranges or get a supplement.
Yeah. Well, I think nowadays everyone gets plenty of vitamin C through their diet. So.
And before we go, what is the best website where we can learn more?
Well, your best source of information is to visit an endodontist, and you can find an endodontist in your area by visiting findmyendodontist.com, and that will locate somebody close to you that you can make an appointment and discuss that. But if you want to research in advance, we have a patient information portion of our website at aae.org.
We want to thank Dr. Craig Noblett from the American Association of Endodontists. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
It is estimated that Franklin County sends as many as 2,000 students to Ohio University in Athens each year. Aside from the academics, Athens was recently named Best College Town in the Midwest in a new survey. Mahalia Buzik is a senior real estate writer and researcher at rentcafe.com. And she joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about all things Athens. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello.
So tell us about the survey. Is this an annual thing?
Yes, this is an annual thing. We started doing this 4 years back, and we've seen great interest. So we kept doing it, and this is our 2026 edition.
Walk me through the methodology behind the research for this survey. How do you gather your data, and what questions do you ask?
So we look at college towns across the country. For this year, we analyzed 244 college towns, and we are looking at three main categories. That's quality of education, quality of life, and affordability. We found that these are the most interesting things for Gen Zs, which are the main cohort heading to university right now. We changed the methodology this year a little bit because we wanted to remove the traditional university reputation scores. And instead, we chose to emphasize factors such as student retention rates, which are generally considered to be an overall happiness metric for universities.
So what is considered a college town as opposed to a city like Columbus, where there are lots of colleges?
So we have actually a pretty strict definition for the college town because we found that to be extremely important when doing a report such as this one. A college town is a place where the university is a major part of the town's identity and culture. It's basically the cultural engine of the community. And we looked at towns with a population between 10,000 and 300,000 people and with a minimum student population of 10%. And that's based on census data. We wanted the universities in these specific towns to have more than 3,000 students enrolled. And these are all degree-granting institutions, and that's how we defined college towns.
What specific details made Athens a candidate?
Well, Athens ranked highly because it answers the needs of Gen Z. So we see great retention and graduation rates at a high university. The city itself has a younger population, and there is a very lively social atmosphere because of that. And even more importantly, we could say there is access to nature, to outdoor recreation, there is good air quality. There is generally a calmer and less overwhelming lifestyle that aligns with Gen Z preferences for wellness and for finding a community of peers with values that align with their own.
So what I'm hearing from you is it's not just what happens on campus, but the surrounding area plays a significant part in the selection. And you talked about outdoors, you know, mm-hmm. Ohio University is a stone's throw from Hocking Hills, which is one of the most coveted recreation areas in the entire state.
Yes, exactly. So we were interested in noting that the fact that today's students care about the overall environment beyond the campus itself. So we looked at nearby natural amenities, entertainment options, as I mentioned, air quality as well. So definitely the surrounding area did play quite an important part in this final ranking as well, especially for general livability.
And this was for the entire Midwest region. So what is the geography that contains Midwest? What states were involved?
Ohio, Michigan, Kansas, Indiana, Missouri. So the national ranking is 25th. So still a pretty, pretty good ranking as well.
Sure. Who were some of the other Ohio college towns besides Athens, and how did they rank?
Well, we see, so in the Midwest, Athens definitely took the first place because of what was mentioned as well, especially the retention rates and the graduation rates. We see Oxford, Ohio as well, and that ranked 20th nationally. We see Kent, Ohio, 77th position as well. So Ohio, as a state, has quite a few entries, but Athens definitely is the standout.
Cheers to Athens and Ohio University, and thanks to Mahalia Buzik from RentCafe.com for joining us. For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Here in Central Ohio, the Franklin County Humane Society regularly cares for as many as 175 cats at a time. Now, 90% of the cats I've adopted in my lifetime have been shelter cats. Almost all of those have been kittens, including my beloved Torty Antoinette, now six, who joined our family when she was just 3 months old. Hannah Shaw, kitten rescuer and New York Times best-selling author, is known as the Kitten Lady, and we are tickled to have her join us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
I'm very happy to have you. Is it true that you've saved more than 250,000 kittens?
That is true. I will say that's not the number that I have myself touched, because that would be a lot of work. But I'm involved in a number of initiatives, of course, fostering my own bottle baby kittens. But I also do a ton of grant work around the United States. So I founded Orphan Kitten Club, which is the largest kitten-focused nonprofit in America. And we're involved all across the country in helping set up kitten programs. Actually, in Ohio, we've done a lot of work there. I was there about a year ago helping with an organization where we set up an entire kitten room there. So I do a lot more work than just the kittens that I foster, but I am also always fostering my babies as well.
So let's go back to the beginning. When did all of this work start for you?
About 17 years ago, I found a little kitten in a tree, and it really opened my eyes to the crisis that we have in this country. You know, there were more than 3 million cats entering shelters last year, and over half of those were kittens. And these kittens are very vulnerable in shelters. You know, especially the youngest kittens are not able to stay there overnight, so they need a special type of support from foster parents. And I became very passionate about educating both shelter employees and members of the public in best practices for kittens so that they can, be saved.
Now, prior to the experience of seeing the kitten in the tree, were you a cat person?
I've been involved in animal advocacy all my life, but the truth is I didn't have any idea how big the issues were with cats prior to that moment. It was very eye-opening, and ever since then, I've been really involved in initiatives to help save their lives.
What's the euthanasia rate right now at shelters nationwide?
Well, I can tell you that for, sadly, when we look at deaths in shelters, about 65% of the deaths that did occur last year were of kittens. So that is why I work with that population. They're a very fragile population, so I really focus in that area. But the great news is that their deaths have decreased a lot over the last 10 years by, like, about 35%. So things are getting better all of the time. There's so many different ways that we can help make things better, and it's what gets me up in the morning, really, is just like working towards those initiatives and campaigns that are making the world a better place to be a cat or a kitten.
I know if you ask a shelter, they always tell you bring bleach and paper towels, but that can't be the biggest thing that shelters are up against right now. What is the top priority as we speak?
Well, there's a lot of different ways that you can help. Certainly, to your point, supplies are a really big need. There are certain supplies that are just critical for animal shelters to have. One of those supplies that shelters absolutely need all the time is litter, and I'm really excited to be part of the Cats Pride Go Big, Go Home campaign right now, because this is a campaign that is coming in right at the time when cats need us most. Cats Pride is donating 1 million pounds of litter to shelters across the country, and this is a really easy way for cat lovers to help when you're, you know, buying litter for your cats. If you reach for Cats Pride, for every container sold, they're donating a pound of litter to shelter cats. So that's a really easy way to help, you know, provide supplies to shelters all across the country. Of course, other ways that you can help would be things like volunteering, adopting, fostering, spaying and neutering the cats in your community. There are a lot of different ways that we can help cats.
I find it difficult personally to foster an animal because I always end up keeping them. So How do you foster an animal, a cat, without developing that emotional attachment that makes it so difficult to say goodbye when they're actually adopted?
Well, I think it's okay to be emotional about the animals that you care for. What I always say about fostering is that goodbye is the goal of fostering. So, you know, the kittens that I take in, they're sometimes quite sick or quite young, and the goal is to get them healthy and old enough for adoption. So once I reach that point where they can go home, I've really achieved my goal. And the important thing about saying goodbye is being able to say hello to the next one. There are so many animals who need help. So it's really more about kind of changing the perspective about what you're doing. Of course, adoption, the goal is to live a long, happy life with this animal. But fostering, the goal is to enable that animal to live a long and happy life with someone else once they are well enough to do so.
One thing I learned very early in life about adopting cats is that you don't choose the cat chooses you. And I've many times been in a room where I just simply sit down and the cat picks me. Do you find that to be true?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic way to adopt. I think sometimes people have a very rigid idea of what they want a cat to look like, or maybe they go to the shelter picturing, like, I want this kind of kitten. And then maybe when you're there, you know, a sweet senior cat catches your eye and just, like, you know, makes biscuits on you, and you go, okay, never mind, I'm in love. And I think that that's a really nice instinct. Of course, you know, it is about adopting with your heart and not with your eyes. And sometimes there are those cats that just pull on your heartstrings. So definitely a good reason to go to the shelter and meet lots of cats so that you can find the one that's the best fit for your home.
How do we know what to feed a cat? A lot of times people will go to a shelter and they literally have no clue how to take care of the animal once they bring it home.
Sure. Well, you know, I would say that different cats need different diets that are, like, based on their age and lifestyle. Of course, talking to your vet is a really good place to start. Some cats need a prescription diet. You know, a kitten needs a kitten-focused diet. The kittens that I work with, you know, I work with bottle babies, so they actually need, like, kitten formula. One thing that my nonprofit does, Orphan Kitten Club, is we provide formula across the country, so we actually have sent a lot of formula to shelters in Ohio this time of year. So sometimes the shelters will have some of those supplies on hand, and they can also tell you what the cat or kitten has already been eating.
Do you remember the shelter that you worked with in Ohio that you talked about at the beginning of the interview?
Yeah, so Toledo Animal Rescue is one shelter that I've been really involved with. They have a great facility, amazing team, and we've helped there with kitten kits and a room, and I've also done some educational work with them.
All right. Well, we are here in Columbus, and we are cat crazy in Columbus. So where can we learn more about your nonprofit, and where can we learn more about fostering and adoption?
Sure. So my nonprofit is Orphan Kitten Club. You can learn about that at orphankittenclub.org. And then definitely I would recommend, if people are interested in supporting litter donations for shelters this time of year, I would recommend going to catspride.com/litterforgood to get involved in that initiative. And then my website is kittenlady.org.
All right. We want to thank Hannah Shaw for joining us today to talk about one of my favorite subjects. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
The state of Ohio just wrapped up a strong fiscal year, seeing tax collections climb well above estimates. The Office of Budget and Management released its preliminary revenue report last week. It shows money flowing into the state at a much higher higher rate than originally estimated, about $1.75 billion more in tax revenue. The 2026 fiscal year ended June 30th. We talked with state leaders about the huge surplus, but first went to Goodale Park in Columbus to see how some people think that extra money should be spent.
We walk every day at lunch, just get some exercise, stay healthy.
We got Tim and Michelle Brack to stop walking for a minute to ask how they think the surplus should be spent.
I think that they should reinvest in the state and do as much as possible to help more housing affordability.
Lynn Williams of Columbus stopped with her dog Earl and told us she'd like to see more investment in infrastructure.
You know, a lot of data centers, et cetera. Businesses are going up and we're going to need that support all the way around.
The Office of Budget and Management report shows in fiscal year 2026 that ended June 30th, the state's total tax revenue was $1.75 billion more than forecast, even stronger than last year when the surplus was $1 billion. This year's surplus is mostly driven by personal income tax receipts that came in $1.1 billion over forecast, followed by sales tax at nearly a half billion. In a statement, OBM Director Kimberly Murnick said, "The budget is balanced and the state of Ohio's financial position has never been stronger. Each of the major tax categories ended fiscal year 2026 solidly above forecast, and fiscal year 2027 is now up and running and off to a great start." House Finance Committee Chairman Republican Brian Stewart says cutting Ohio's highest income tax rate and implementing a 2.75% flat tax is working.
We've always argued that if you let Ohioans keep more of their own money, they're going to invest in this economy. They're going to jumpstart our economic activity, and we're seeing that now through higher collections.
Republican State Representative David Thomas says the surplus was expected, and about three quarters of the money is already spoken for.
The $350 million to our seniors in the homestead relief, doubling the amount of property tax credits that our seniors are getting. About $320 million to our sales tax holiday fund.
In a statement to 10TV, House Minority Leader Democrat Dunny Isaacson said of the revenue increase, "Unfortunately, the majority in the legislature always chooses to spend any additional revenue directly on more tax benefits to the richest corporations and Ohioans, ignoring the need for more affordable medicine, lower utility bills, and property tax relief."
And joining me now to talk about the big surplus and the role of the Office of Budget and Management is OBM Director Kimberly Murnix. Director Murnix, thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Doug. I'm really happy to be here, and happy fiscal new year to you.
Fiscal new year. That's the first time I've ever been wished that. I think it's appropriate to wish it back to you, I suppose.
Thank you.
So what does the size of this tax revenue surplus, roughly $1.75 billion, say about the financial standing of the state of Ohio?
The state's financial position has never been stronger. We are seeing really strong revenue performance in all of our major categories. Our largest category is the state sales tax, and we finished about 6% above our projections on sales taxes. Next largest category are income taxes, and we saw a really strong performance there as well. Ohio's unemployment rate continues to be low, and much of the overage in this past fiscal year was driven by strong stock market returns in tax year 2025, which translates into our fiscal 26 revenues.
I was going to ask that again, because how does the surplus grow basically $750 million from last fiscal year to this fiscal year?
It grows because we, first of all, budget conservatively here in the state of Ohio. We budget 2 years at a time. We have a biennial budget. And because we have to plan 2 years in advance, there are always a lot of uncertainties. So we ensure that our budget plan is conservative and that we will have the resources to fund it. If we're going to err, we want to make sure we are erring on the side of having sufficient revenues and having a surplus, as opposed to not having the resources to support all of the programs and needs of Ohioans that are supported through the state budget.
So how are forecasts made on the fiscal projections for tax revenue income?
We actually work with several different firms that do economic projections. And we also have a board of economic advisors, economists from all over the state, including from our universities, from our corporate universe here in Ohio, and some national experts. So we work in partnership with the Department of Taxation. They do the revenue forecast using the baselines from all of that data. And that informs the priorities that then we are able to support in the state budget. So every 2 years, we take in all of the data. We have sophisticated models that have looked at how performance has been in the past based on the situation that we're seeing at the time. And then we try to look in our crystal ball and see what we think the next 2 years are going to look like.
So you talk about the budget itself being conservative, but
yes.
are the estimates too conservative if you're getting the projections too conservative if you're having a surplus like $1.75 billion?
Well, this year, this past the current tax year that we're in, tax year 26, was the first year of Ohio's flat income tax. Mm-hmm. So given that we were making all of the adjustments, mm-hmm. we definitely wanted to err on the side of conservative.
Was that because some people were talking like maybe $1 billion less would come in because of the cut?
It's kind of an art and a science when you're doing these sure. kinds of forecasts. And a lot depends on the global economy. And of course, that can change very quickly. We always look at all of the potential risks out there too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not just in Ohio, but globally, and have to take that into account. So given that we were making some changes to our tax structure, given just uncertainties that always exist, again, we want to make sure that our revenue projections will support the budget that's passed. And then if there is a surplus, we utilize that to make investments in usually in one-time expenses that can then make a difference for the long term for Ohioans.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.